writers' voices, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, subbing for Monica Hadley and her mom, Carolyn, who normally hosts the show. With me today, I have St. Louis author Dean Klinkenberg, who began traveling along the Mississippi River Valley in the summer of 2007 to work on a new series of comprehensive travel guides. And I've had the opportunity to look over some of these guides, and I think they're really valuable for people of all ages. I think it would be great for families, especially in these times when people aren't traveling as far as they usually do. It's a nice alternative to spending a lot of money going on longer trips. So people from the Midwest, I think, would be especially interested in these books. His series is called the Mississippi Valley Traveler Series, and it currently includes three books. Dean published first the Quad Cities Travel Guide in June of 2009 and the Lansing to LeClaire Travel Guide in October of that year. The third book just came out in November 2010. It's called The Driftless Area Along the Mississippi River from Hastings, Minnesota to Lansing, Iowa. He's designed these guides for budget-conscious travelers, and I think writers will be particularly interested in what he has to say because he started out as a psychologist doing research on HIV and AIDS and homelessness and mental illness, and decided after working at that for some intense years to set out, begin writing, and see what he could do self-publishing. And so I'm pleased to welcome Dean Klinkenberg. Welcome, Dean.
Thanks, Cheryl. It's a pleasure to be here in Fairfield.
I think there's a lot that you can teach us about the writing and publishing process. The first thing I was thinking of was, how did you organize all this material?
Well, I have a very complicated system. I'm very obsessive about my note-taking, and I started off using an Access database to keep track of the major types of sites I wanted to keep track of, but ultimately I have notebooks, I have voice recorders, I have a filing system at home. Anything I can come up with, you know, any time I need to take a note, I need to have a variety of methods to take the notes. So I use whatever's available, and then I try to write as soon as I can. So, you know, when I did the first book, I came up with a general format for how I wanted to present the information. So when I was out on the road, I would take my notes and try to translate them into text as soon as I could, and organized into the sections that I thought I wanted to use for the final product. So,
is it sort of a quixotic process? I mean, is it just sort of the luck of the draw what you find in a particular place, or did you have pretty clear idea of what you would find when you went, like having researched it beforehand?
I do a fair amount of research before I leave home. So I've done, I use the net, you know, I try to find other books that have been done on areas. I read a lot of local history. All of that kind of gives me a sense of some of the places I'd like to see before I get there. But, you know, I don't stay handcuffed by that. You know, when I'm on the road, I want to be open to finding things that I didn't know something about already. And, you know, for that, you know, you've just got to be on the ground, in the community, talking to people. You know, for me, I find that bars and diners are really good places to talk to folks and get information, and those are places you're more likely to meet a lot of local people rather than just other tourists.
So is that what you think distinguishes your travel guide than, say, you know, if someone would be traveling through Iowa and get an Iowa travel guide from AAA?
Well, there are many things that distinguish mine from theirs, but one of the key differences is my book, for better or worse, what's in there is based on my judgment. There are no paid listings. I don't, you know, have paid advertisements in the books. A lot of the guides that you get for free, the listings are in there because somebody paid to be in there. So you don't really know if they've been evaluated for quality or vetted in any way. In my books, you know, like I said, for better or worse, it's my judgment whether or not the places are any good. And I put it in based on my experiences and what I think would be interesting for visitors. So that's one big difference. Plus, I go out of my way to highlight independently run businesses. So, you know, occasionally I might include a chain hotel, particularly if they have a property that's right on the river in a very attractive location. But for the most part, I'm writing about independently run restaurants and places to stay and shopping, you know, commercial businesses. So
one of the things that distinguishes your book then is that kind of local flavor, local color. You're not talking about McDonald's and Hy-Vee. You're talking about local eateries.
Yeah, McDonald's and Hy-Vee will never be in my books, so well, they can take care of themselves.
They don't need to be. So what gave you the idea? Like, I think that's a really important principle for writers, is to find out what distinguishes you from what's already been published. And we know there's a lot of travel guides out there already. So you had a particular slant. But what gave you the idea to write travel guides?
I've been a travel junkie for a long time. It's probably my parents' fault, at least in part. I know we used to pack up the station wagon and take summer vacations for a couple weeks when I was growing up. So that was always a very much a part of my life, was being out on the road and exploring new places. And I kept doing that as an adult. So I think what happened for me, I followed a little different career path, as you mentioned. You know, most writers probably don't go to graduate school for psychology and then at some point decide they want to do something completely different that they didn't go to school for. So my own career was interesting for a while, but I found the work getting more and more bureaucratic and administrative. I need to be kind of out in the field interacting with people to really feel satisfied with the work that I was doing. And my job writing grants and managing grants was getting to be more and more desk bound.
Grant writing is a special art, and I think I've done a little bit of that, and it's very arduous. So I could see where after a while you could get a little burnt out doing grant writing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for me, it was just getting to a point where I wasn't feeling very satisfied with the work. And at that time, just happened to coincide with when I was doing a lot of international travel. And reading a lot of travel writing and thinking about ways that I might be able to make a living from some travel-related occupation. And I thought, you know, I'm not a bad writer. Maybe I can do some travel writing. And I made the big decision. Oh, go ahead.
Had you done any sort of writing besides academic writing and grant writing at that point?
No, not in a long time. You know, I had every now and then, you know, I'd spend a little time writing some short poems just for myself, but nothing that was written for an audience. So I had to retrain myself, because you probably could guess, you know, academic writing has a very formal, very constrained style. And although I think I had a very good handle on how to construct sentences and communicate, and I got a lot of compliments on my writing, it's a very different kind of writing to go and write about travel and to write for a popular audience. So,
right. And you've done that in a really interesting way, I feel. Just having thumbed through a couple of your books in the last couple days, it doesn't have, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to guess that you had spent most of your time doing grant writing, which is can be kind of an obtuse sort of writing to read. This is really colloquial. It's fun. You have lots of maps and colored pictures, and sometimes you're talking about serious history in these books, like a connection to the Dred Scott decision in one of your little blurbs, and other times it's just colorful, almost historical gossip. So I think you did a good job of reaching your audience. One of the things I think would particularly interest writers is how you took that leap to decide, because these are self-published.
Yes.
So in the old days, you know, before we had easy access to publishing on the internet, people used to frown on self-publishing because of the problem of distribution. So that's a lot different today, and you're in that forefront of people who are now taking, you know, your own independent, autonomous path and going around. And I think people would be interested in how that process is going for you. How is the marketing going? Because that's the big problem, I think, with self-publishing.
It is, and I'm still trying to figure a lot of this out. It's a lot of work, and I think going into this, I underestimated how much time I was going to have to spend on the marketing end. But realistically, I think I have to spend as much time marketing as I do writing and producing the books in the first place if I'm going to make a living from this. So, you know, I can tell you what I've done up to this point is I hooked up with Big River Magazine. They publish a monthly or semi-monthly magazine based in Winona, Minnesota, and they do some book distribution also. They helped me produce the first couple of books, do all the layout, and make sure that it looked really good. But they were also really interested in helping distribute this book. And because they were an established magazine, they had a distribution network already in place for the magazine. So we were able to work with their existing network to get into, say, Partners, which distributes to a lot of bigger bookstores like Barnes & Noble. And then they will also distribute to the smaller independent bookstores throughout the upper Midwest that I want to market to. I started off doing it myself and directly going to bookstores and marketing on my own, and after a while, it was getting to be too much for me to manage because I couldn't really stay on top of which bookstores had how many books and how often should I be contacting them to check on inventory. So I turned that all over to Big River and let them handle that, and then I do press releases, and I still contact bookstores and other places where I can talk about the books and about travel.
And was it difficult to convince this, what was it called, Big River? Was it difficult to convince them to take you on?
No, it was their idea, really.
And how did you connect with them? Did you just read about them somewhere?
Yeah, when I started thinking about writing about travel along the Mississippi and I was trying to identify magazines or books about the river, I came across their publication. And because I also know I need to do a variety of types of products to make a living from this, it seemed like their magazine was one that might be a good target for some articles that I might put together along the way. Because, you know, I figured that to stay afloat financially, I'm going to be doing a lot of different products. I'm going to have to write shorter pieces while I'm researching the books to have some money coming in. And then the books would provide a different income stream. And they were the first one that I approached. I just gave them a call and said, hey, I'm going to be writing about the river, and I'd like to stop by and talk to you. And it's kind of blossomed from there.
Well, I think there's a lesson there for writers, too, because you targeted a company that was doing exactly, something that dovetailed really nicely with what your project focused on. So that's, you did your market research in advance, and it seems like that was really useful because that's a great relationship to have if they're the ones who are taking care of getting your books in bookstores.
Right, and it's provided an outlet. I think I've published 4 or 5 articles in their magazine since then. So that's been a good partnership. It's been good for both of us, I think, because it also helps them develop, to diversify a little bit of their income streams as well.
So I just want to say again, this is KRUU-FM 101 in Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. It's a community-supported radio station. You're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson subbing for Monica Hadley and her mom, Carolyn. And with me today is Dean Klinkenberg, and he tells me there's another Klinkenberg author who he is not related to. Would you just explain?
Yeah, Verlin Klinkenberg, I guess, is an Iowa native who writes novels, and people ask me all the time, especially people in Iowa, if I'm related to him, and sorry to say I'm not, as far as I know.
I think it's nice to have an unusual name when you're a writer, so it's surprised me that there are 2 Klinkenbergs writing here. Would you tell us a little bit more about what's in your books? Because I think that you've done a great job of gathering things that people would want to know. And in your back of your book, it says that you include information about what to do, where to stay, where to eat, where to hang out, where to go for the occasional splurge. So how did you decide what to put in your book and what is in there?
Well, I think the overall guiding principle for this is I want to help steer people to have experiences that give them a sense of each community. Not just to have a sense of what a Big Mac tastes like in Davenport versus Dubuque, but to understand maybe what makes Davenport a little different from Dubuque. So to do that, you have to have kind of a wide range of experiences when you're in a place. So, I mean, the obvious thing would be to include all the museums, the standard kinds of guidebook places, and I do include those. But I'm also trying to look for those smaller sometimes they're museums, sometimes they're just one person's eccentric collection that they've built over the years that they make open to the public that might give you a sense of that community or at least one character in that community. I'm looking for those kinds of places. I'm also looking for ways to get out and hike or bike and experience the communities from the perspective on the ground rather than just looking out your car window and watching it as you drive by. And then identifying interesting places to eat or have a drink, or if the food really isn't that good, at least some place that's more popular with locals. So you go to eat at a diner that may not have the best food, maybe it's just going to be hamburgers and pancakes, but it might have a really interesting group of people that hang out there regularly that you can talk to and get to know a little bit more about the town that way. And then, of course, places to stay. And again, I'm always looking for independently run places to highlight. So you know, my bar sometimes to me seems a little bit too low, maybe, that if it's an independently run accommodation, especially, if they let me visit and have a look around, then they're almost always going to be included in the book. I think there have been maybe a couple of times I visited some kind of accommodation where I thought it was really awful and decided not to include it. But for the most part, especially with accommodations, if I get to look around, it's going to be in.
So you really have this populist philosophy about travel. And it seems like that'd be a little difficult for many people to just be traveling around where you often probably don't know anybody and trying to find out what the heart of that community is. So what in your background, do you think your psychology degree like helped prepare you to just make all these cold calls, more or less?
The cold calls never get easier. I can tell you that. It's not my favorite part of doing this. When I have to call a B&B or an inn of some kind to set up an appointment to tour it, that's my least favorite part of this whole process because, well, they get inundated with calls from marketers. So they initially they think I'm just another telemarketer and I have to get past that resistance. But so that part never really gets easier and I don't really like it.
Oh, I'm surprised you're doing this. I thought, oh, he must be like really gregarious if he's traveling around talking to all these people.
Once I'm there and I get to talk to them, it's a different experience on site, then I like that part of it much better. It's more that cold call that I don't really enjoy that.
Now that you have three of the books published, is that easier because you can refer them to your website? Do you want to tell us what your website is?
It's MississippiValleyTraveler.com. And I'm hoping to revamp it a little bit in the next couple of months, but right now it's mostly travel content to describe some of what's in the book as reflected on the website. And there's information on how to purchase the travel guides. But since I started this, I've also been blogging about my experiences and occasionally writing a piece to highlight a local restaurant or some other unknown attraction that I was really excited about. That information is not accessible at the moment. I'm hoping to get that integrated into Mississippi Valley Traveler as soon as maybe mid-January. It'll be a mix of both of those things.
Is there a time management issue with this? Because you have to spend a lot of time traveling, and then if you're blogging is also kind of a time sink, and trying to organize your material and write the books, I mean, how do you efficiently go about all these different tasks?
This is probably one thing from my academic career helped with, was prioritizing and understanding deadlines and what needs to be done first. So when I'm getting better, I think, now at managing my time when I'm on the road. So I make the most of the time that I have. And the priority, it has to be to do those things that can only be done on site. I can read books or magazines at home or check websites back home. I can verify a lot of contact information from home. But I can't tour the B&B unless I'm on site. I can't check out the restaurant unless I'm there. So there are those kinds of things that end up being the highest priority. And hiking, I can't get much of a feel for a park or a natural area without getting out on the ground and hiking around the place for a little while to see whether it's an interesting place for a hike. So all of those kinds of things take the first priority when I'm on the road.
I could see where if you are hiking, that would be a nice change from, obviously you've said some of the time you're writing because you have to take these notes while you're there. So you might be sitting in a coffee shop or sitting in a hotel room or sitting and talking to people. If you do too much of that, you really do need to move around. So it's probably great that you're also getting out there and checking out the parks and places like that.
Yeah, this is a balance that I'm still sometimes trying to find where the best midpoint is. But I want to have a good experience myself when I'm in these places, and I don't want to get so caught up in trying to do all the research that I miss out on the joys of being a traveler in the first place. I don't want to turn this into such a job that it's just a grind to get through every day. So
if you did do that, it probably would have a negative effect on your writing because it would be hard to be enthusiastic about a place if you weren't kind of getting a little bit of the joy of the place.
Right. So I do make sure to work in some of that time for those hikes and to hang out at an interesting place to have a beverage and talk to folks. So, and it's been a blessing that way. And I have friends all along the river now from St. Louis up to the Twin Cities. So I think that's probably worked out pretty good.
Do you make return visits after the book comes out?
I do, and I make a lot of visits in the interim, too. This may change for the next book because the distance is getting to be a lot further. But since I live in St. Louis, you know, I could drive up to the Quad Cities very easily and do a week up in the Quad Cities and go home and for a week or two and then come back up. The longer the driving distances get, the harder it is to do that because I lose 2 days to driving back and forth. Mm. So this summer I ended up spending 3 weeks in La Crosse and Red Wing, Minnesota to get a lot of progress done and not be driving back and forth.
Did you go to clown camp?
I did not.
Didn't go? A magazine sent me to clown camp for a week years ago. I wrote an article about clown camp after participating, and it was a really interesting experience.
What community was that in?
That was in La Crosse.
Okay.
But it was actually Wisconsin. So you travel around. Are you finding it a little wearying to be gone from home so much?
It does get, the hard part is, especially when I get to a new community where I don't have any contacts yet, then it can get lonely. You know, it can be difficult being on the road for longer stretches of time and being away from friends and family. So I do try to force myself to be out a little bit more often. Some of the newer places where I don't know anybody, so I can start to develop some friendships and meet some people, or at least have some human contact other than asking what's your phone number and how much does it cost to stay here.
So we were talking before about the balance. I forget exactly what we were talking about, but there is striking that balance between writing and being gregarious and being out. Was it frightening to quit your job to pursue this?
It was. I mean, it felt like a big risk. For the first couple of years, I had a bit of a safety net. I left the university and my university job in 2006, and then I had a couple of years where I was consulting with companies or universities that I had existing relationships with. So I had some income as a consultant instead of as an employee. And this past year, that pretty much dried up. So now I'm full-time travel writer, for better or worse.
Well, I'm sure that makes writer's block a thing of the past. You know, if you don't have a cushion, it would be a lot harder to procrastinate because you know you have to get something written to be ready to sell it. But we were also talking about your return visits to communities, and when you have the book to show them, is it sort of exciting for the people from the communities to read about themselves, or what's the response been when you go back?
It's been very good. People are especially since a lot of these communities haven't appeared in other guidebooks.
Because they're too small?
Yeah. I don't think anybody else has written about North Buena Vista, Iowa, for example. And, of course, I haven't really chatted with them since the book came out, but there are a lot of communities like that are really excited to see their communities represented in a book that is going to be available, well, in theory, to the rest of the world, but certainly to travelers along the river. Some of them maybe wonder a little bit at times why I'm writing about their communities as a lifelong resident. Sometimes they don't really understand the appeal that community might have to visitors.
Suspicious, you mean? Like
not suspicious, just I think they don't get it, why a tourist might want to come to their little community. It's not a bad thing. I think everybody is pretty excited to have their towns represented. And, I try to say for the most, where I can, I say good things. Occasionally, something critical needs to be said, but I try to keep that to a minimum.
Thumbing through the books, I haven't found anything very critical so far. Mostly
good.
It was just fun to read. Would you like to read a little?
Sure.
And let readers get a firsthand impression of what you're writing. So this is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writers' Voices at KRUU-FM 101 community-supported radio. And with me today is Dean Klinkenberg, who's writing travel guides. He's already published 3 travel guides for communities along the Mississippi.
So I'll read a little section from the history of Onalaska, Wisconsin, which is a town that began as a logging community. It's just north of La Crosse. Thomas Rowe, a native New Yorker, arrived in the area in 1851, apparently with the idea of opening a tavern to serve the lumberjacks working along the Black River, which seems like it must have been a good idea given their numbers in the area. Mr. Rowe was a fan of Thomas Campbell, whose poem The Pleasures of Hope references a town in the Alaskan Aleutian Islands that provided the inspiration from the town's name. And here's a section from that poem. Now for he sweeps where scarce the summer smiles on Bering's rocks or Greenland's naked isles. Cold on his midnight watch the breezes flow from wastes that slumber in eternal snow and waft across the waves' tumultuous roar the wolf's long howl from on Alaska's shore. William Carlyle, a lumberman by trade, was so taken with the name that after he left the area, he used it three more times to establish communities in Arkansas, Texas, and Washington. Back to lumber. The first sawmill went up around 1853, and by 1856, there were three sawmills in operation and two more under construction. Most of the workers were immigrants from Germany and Norway. From 1855 to 1899, over 6 billion board feet of lumber floated down the Black River to Onalaska. That's enough lumber to build 2 million three-bedroom, 1,000-square-foot ranch houses. That's a lot of lumber. During the early years, the mills kicked out a lot of sawdust as a byproduct. For a while, the sawdust was dumped on roads to make them more passable, which turned out to be not such a good idea because sawdust is, of course, flammable. And while flaming streets might be a really cool effect in a video game, they aren't so good for a town trying to convince people to stick around. The lumber business peaked in 1892. 10 years later, it was essentially done as the forests had been depleted. Employment at the Black River Mills fell from 1,785 at the turn of the century to 39 people just 6 years later.
Wow, that's a big change in a short amount of time.
It is.
I found your little historical tidbits really interesting. And just to give listeners an idea of the range, I was wondering if you would tell them about two different little anecdotes that you include. One was about the Putnam Gray House and the sisters of that house, and also how the Dred Scott decision came up in one of your books.
All right. Well, the Putnam Gray was a classic eccentric personality. He lived in a little community of Minnieska, Minnesota, which is between Wabasha and Winona, for those of you keeping track at home. And over the years, he collected, there's some dispute about exactly where all the wood came from, but it seems like he used wood that had been abandoned from the log rafts or that had kind of floated down river. He used this surplus wood to construct what everybody called Gray's Castle. It kind of looked like a big riverboat, but it was a house on the bank of the river.
There's a great picture. Listeners, of course, won't know this, but there's a great picture in the book where it's this really comical, gigantic mansion that looks like it's just balanced on rocks over the river. So it's really an interesting photo to
include. Yeah, and don't you think it has kind of a steamboat shape to it?
It did. It had a lot of character.
Kind of looks like a grounded steamboat, I guess, but looking like it could fall apart with the next wind that blows down the river. So his family lived there for quite a few years, and his daughters used to play this game, or his sisters, I guess it was his sisters, used to play this game where they, at night, when the steamboats would come downriver, they would shine a spotlight along the shore to make sure they didn't hit it. So the sisters would cover themselves with white sheets and run out on the deck, on the balcony, and they would run around and pretend they were ghosts. So the spotlight would kind of shine on them. And for years, there were these stories about Gray's Castle being haunted, and nobody knew that the sisters were the ones who were behind this. Now, the other thing that's interesting about him is apparently he invented the Ferris wheel. I mean, there's a little bit more work going on about this yet, but the story that I read that seems to have some documentation behind it is that he invented this ride that later became known as a Ferris wheel, and he first displayed it at a fair in Winona. And Ferris, who gets the credit, who is the wheel is named after, saw it and pursued him for a while until he convinced him to sell the rights for him to exhibit it, which he then did at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
So those eccentric people are useful to have around because they invent things for us.
They tend to be creative.
I can't say I have a lot of use for Ferris wheels personally, but I'm sure they've brought pleasure to a lot of people. But what you've just said did bring up one point. You're including a lot of information in your books, and authenticating the information is something that must be quite a chore.
And that's where my background in psychology and particularly in research really comes in handy. I have a natural skepticism about most things that I read. And if I come across a story like this one with Putnam Gray and the Ferris wheel, you know, I'll note it at first, but then I'll probably dig around and try to find another source or two to verify that before I include it in the book. Some things, if they're just really interesting sounding stories, you know, I may just say, hey, you know, I heard or I read about this story. I don't know if it's really true, but it's entertaining anyway. So I try to qualify those things and I really do try to go out of my way to be as accurate as I can and understand the sources that I'm working with and try to verify from a couple sources on some of the more controversial issues.
Yeah, I think that that's a legitimate way to get around that is having most of the stuff be authentic, and then occasionally including those stories that have local color and just explaining that this is a tale that's told in this town, and you're not making any claims that it actually happened.
Right.
You know, might have not. You were also going to tell us about the Dred Scott decision and what you found out in one of the communities you visited.
Yeah, I didn't know about this connection until I started researching the Quad Cities book, but I live in St. Louis, so I'm certainly familiar with the Dred Scott decision that initially was ruled in his favor from the circuit court in St. Louis before the Supreme Court overturned it.
Some people may have forgotten, so why don't you explain what the whole case was about?
I'll do the best that I can, but some of my my memory might be a little foggy on some of the exact details of this. But you know, the basics of the story are that Dred Scott was a slave, and I'm blanking on his owner's name at the moment, but they came up to the Quad Cities area in the 1840s and in the early 1840s and built a home at the site of where the Twin Bridges are right now in Bettendorf on the Iowa side, and lived there for a couple of years and moved up to Fort Snelling, where Dred Scott met Harriet, that he later married, and then they moved back to St. Louis. And at the time, there was a provision I think this was an Illinois law, there was a provision in Missouri law that if you were a slave and you had lived at one time in an area that was not a slave state, that you were free. So Dred Scott sued for his freedom based on the fact that he had lived in a territory that was not a slave state. And initially, the early ruling of the court from the circuit court that met in St. Louis, the federal circuit court, ruled in his favor and said that you're right, you know, according to these laws, you're now a free man. And of course, this decision was appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, which ruled in 1856, around there, that slaves were property and not people, and that Dred Scott was still the property of his owners because the Constitution protects property rights.
It seems so recent, really, when you think about it. 1856 doesn't seem that long ago. But that decision then sort of touched off or helped spark the Civil War.
Yes.
So that's just an example of how I feel your books would be really useful for families or school teachers, you know, anyone who's exploring an area, or even if you live in that town and know a lot already, you might not have heard about that connection. So I think that'd be really a good way for people to learn a little bit of history in kind of a painless manner, you know, being able to see a place and then read a little story about why it's significant.
Mm-hmm. You know, now that I think about this too, I don't believe they have a marker in Bettendorf to mark the site where Dred Scott lived, and I think that's probably something they should do.
Well, I hope somebody is listening.
If you're listening over there in the Quad Cities.
This is streamed on the internet, so someone could be listening that could do something, or maybe we could write them a letter. So I don't know if everybody's aware, this is Dean Klinkenberg who's writing these travel guides. So you're planning to do the whole length of the Mississippi?
That's the plan.
And it seems like you got these first three books out in pretty rapid succession, right? It was like June and then October.
Yeah, I'd been working on the first two for a couple of years. You know, when I first started doing this, I wasn't really sure if this was a direction I wanted to go. So I spent kind of the better part of a summer doing what I thought of as one long pilot test to figure out how to go about researching it, trying to figure out what content exactly I would want to include in the books. And then I followed up with that the following year to really dig in and get all the details
finished. Well, you know,
finished.
That interests me a lot, because I think one thing that happens to creative people, like writers, is there'll be so many projects that come into your head. There's so many things you think about doing, and it's hard. You can spend so much energy trying to decide between competing projects that it's hard to pick which one to run with and actually finish something. So it fascinates me that you had some kind of process where you delved into it to test it. So what exactly did that consist of? You just said, I'm going to set aside this summer and see if this is workable?
Yeah, and it started off really as short trips up to the Quad Cities. Yeah, it seemed like, yeah, I was up in the Quad Cities, I think, in January of 2007 for a consulting job. And I'd already been thinking about doing these travel guides at that point. So while I was there, I thought I would poke around to a couple places just to, you know, get a sense for the area. And I had such a good time that first visit. In fact, you know, one of the first people I met there at the time, he was bartending at one of the brew pubs. And it's somebody that is still a friend of mine that I see most of the time when I go visit. So that first visit convinced me that there was going to be plenty of material to work with in the Quad Cities, and that I would start to focus on that area. It was far enough from home that it was new and different, but it was close enough that I could get up there in 4 hours and spend a weekend there if that's all the time that I had. And in the beginning, that's really all I did have. That first year, I was still working 3 or 4 days a week as a consulting with other projects in St. Louis. So I'd be lucky to get 4 days in a row off to go on the road.
I think that's another principle that's probably wise for people to pay attention to, is to do something, start with something that's a little more doable. Because if you had started trying to write a book for a place that was far away, there were so many things that would have been new, because the first book, I would imagine, was a lot harder than the subsequent two.
Yeah.
So I think if there's some way to make that first project easier, if you're planning something that's a series, how many books do you think there are going to be in this series?
That's an open question still. It's probably looking like 7 or 8. But it just kind of depends on how many volumes I break the lower river into. I don't really know how much there is going to be to write about, especially when I get south of the Ohio River. Is there a lot of, you know, the river is very different down there. There aren't as many communities right along the river, and the river is hidden from a lot of towns by big levees. Huh. So I don't quite know what to expect yet. I mean,
but
I could probably...
By the time you get to that part of the river, you will have the process of writing the books down pretty well, though, it sounds
right.
like.
And it looks like right now, one book a year is probably about the pace that's going to work.
Another principle that writers use a lot, people who are trying to make their living writing, is to use the same information multiple ways and, you know, write different kinds of projects. Are you thinking about, you've said you're doing magazine articles and you're doing books, and it sounds like you've tinkered with poetry. There's not a lot of money to be made in poetry, but are you thinking about writing poetry about some of these places you visit too?
No, not so much. I mean, I've thought about using different locations maybe for a novel. You know, once I get really familiar with particular communities, I can think of some interesting stories that could be told in a novel format. I don't really know that I'm going to do that. I mean, I think my strength is probably writing nonfiction more so than fiction.
Have you thought about writing a how to write a travel guide?
I could do that, yeah. Yeah, and if anybody needs, you know, a seminar speaker to talk about travel writing, I'm sure we could work something out for that too. So,
A lot of the children's writers I know, I've spent a lot of time around children's writers. Oh, I also wanted to say Quad Cities. I really enjoy the Quad Cities. I don't think I have visited the Quad Cities, you know, because I don't spend much time in brew pubs. But I've been to so many children's writers conferences there over the years, and I've always really enjoyed Quad Cities. Gone to take a lot of little seminars and things.
Yeah, I love it there. It has a lot of the amenities of a big city without a lot of the hassles. So, and you know, I think I probably use this line in the book too. But you know, there are a lot of places that claim that their people are very friendly, and you know, that's our greatest asset. But I really think that is actually true in the Quad Cities.
Right.
People just seem, for whatever reason, you know, I've had so many experiences where people I just met went out of their way to be friendly and helpful, and it happened with much more frequency there than a lot of other places I visited.
That's a lesson for communities, is to always, you know, welcome people, because now you've done that first travel guide about the Quad Cities, and that'll be a marketing tool for the towns themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be doing a lot more traveling still. Are you looking forward to the future and thinking about what you want to do? I guess these novels, possibly.
That's a possibility. There are a couple of ideas bouncing around for that. For the time being, I think I'm really looking forward to developing more opportunities to get out and talk to people about travel, too. So tonight I'll be at Revelations Cafe, not just talking about the books, but I love travel and I love talking to people about travel. I've done a lot of independent travel outside the U.S. and around the U.S., and I have some pretty strong convictions about how to do that. So I love having the opportunity to talk to people about those kinds of things, and I'm looking forward to doing more of that.
What time were you going to be at Revelations tonight?
6 o'clock tonight.
6 o'clock, Revelations in Fairfield. Dean Klinkenberg, author of these travel guides. So let's see. Oh, I was talking about a little bit about the children's writers that I know. Many children's writers make a good part of their money from their speaking engagements. So do you have any advice about what you've learned about structuring talks, or are you just kind of getting started on that part of your career?
I'm still learning how best to do this. When I first started doing these last year, I think my focus was a little too narrow. I'm trying to find a way to keep the themes general and to make sure that it would appeal to a wide audience and not just to people who might want to travel specifically along the Mississippi. And in the beginning, I had some really nice slides and some good stories about travel along the Mississippi, but that's all that it really was. And I really wanted to build on that.
To a wider audience.
Yes. So I still talk a lot about travel along the Mississippi, but now I do it in a context about how to travel to get that sense of what makes a community tick, just using examples from Mississippi River towns primarily.
Uh-huh. Well, I think for some authors, having to do public speaking is onerous because some people who like to write are, people who enjoy having some seclusion. So there is that other aspect of having to market what you write.
Right. And for me, I'm not Stephen King or, I don't have best-selling books. I have to look for multiple ways to make a buck to make this work. And I think over time, public speaking is one way I can make some extra money, and that fits in very well with what I'm doing. Book sales, writing for magazines. I take my own pictures as well, so I'm trying to scale up, selling photos in the next couple of years also.
Have you thought about doing projects like Studs Terkel? Used to do those books like Working, because you're meeting all these people from all over, these little towns.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about recording interviews with some of these people? And
I would love to do more of that. I've done 3 or 4 already.
For your magazine work?
I haven't written, other than transcribing the interviews, I haven't put them in written format just yet. I feel like I need to come up with some unifying theme.
Right.
And I don't have a theme in my head yet, other than these are really interesting people that I love talking to. So I think the next few months, since I'm probably not going to be researching the next guidebook just yet, but I will be on the road, I'm going to try to do more interviews and just collect some stories and see if I can identify a theme from all that might help tie some of these together.
Yeah, I think part of it is doing things that you like. I mean, if you quit your better, I'm not saying university job was probably a tremendously paying job, but it was certainly more secure than what you're doing now.
Right.
But if you quit something like that is stable, you have to be enjoying the process of what you're doing, because otherwise, why have changed careers?
Right.
So
this is a good fit for me. I don't mind traveling at all. I like being on the road and meeting new people and discovering new places, and I love hearing people's stories. So again, the trick is just figuring out a way to turn that into a business plan that has some viability to it. But if you don't like what you're doing, then what's the point?
Yeah. So in touching on this idea of turning it into a business plan, did you do much research on how to be successful from the business viewpoint? Not so much like how to write or how to organize your material or how to be an entrepreneur?
I went to a weekend travel writing institute in Florida that was very helpful, more helpful than I think I expected it to be. but it was helpful because it gave me a sense of the number of different ways that were out there to make money. And granted, you know, this field is changing quickly. Any kind of freelance writing, you know, the markets are in flux right now, and you know, the magazine you wrote for last year may be out of business this year. So you have fewer magazines and just as many people writing and trying to get paid from the same publication. So it's a very competitive environment. But that weekend, I think, really helped me understand that there's more than that route that where you can potentially make some money. It's just that it takes a lot of different kinds of efforts, a lot of different products to be able to make it work full time. So I did that research. You know, I went to that seminar, and then I did some specific market research for these books, just trying to get a sense of what people had written about the Mississippi. Were there some travel books already on the river? And I didn't really see anything. You know, there is one other series of guidebooks, but it seemed like they went in a very different direction than what I wanted to do. So after all that, it felt like there was definitely a niche that I could fill with these books, and it's time to dive in.
Well, you were talking about different products. So is one of those different products updating this information in the print books? Because these are great books. I like the size of them because they'd easily fit in a backpack. You know, it wouldn't be onerous to have to carry this around in a purse or a backpack. I like that in this one called The Driftless Area, you have these little tabs so that you can just look at the, the pages of the book, and if you pick a tab, it's kind of like organized by state. They're just like very nicely organized, but we know that print materials become obsolete. Mm-hmm. And is there a way that you're going to be able to make money by updating the books online, or would that just, are you still trying? I think most people, even big companies, are trying to figure out how you make money with information online. But
right. And when you figure that out, let me know, because I'm first in line to take advantage of that. There are some of the content for the books is online now. I haven't done as much yet from the newest book. But it doesn't have everything, because there are some pieces of information that would be so time-consuming to keep up to date, I decided not to include. So, for example, online, I don't publish prices for accommodations. You know, prices change. I don't put admission prices for museums or operating hours for businesses. You know, just getting the operating hours pinned down for a business for the print guide was extremely time-consuming. So those kinds of things I didn't put in the print guide. And
online I could see where if you name the museum, many museums will have a website of their own, or even if it's a small town, they'll have maybe a visitors bureau that would have that kind of information. So people could easily go from your site to a site from the town and get that.
And I do provide links to businesses that I mention online. So if you want to know the hours for the Putnam Museum in Davenport, I'll have a link embedded in the text for the Putnam, so you can go right to it and see the hours. So yeah, so there's less of a need for that for the online version. What the online version does allow me to do is remove businesses that have closed, which I can't do until the print guide until the next edition. But I would hope at some point I'll be doing revisions for these. But ultimately it's about whether I'm making enough money to make it worthwhile, to be honest. You know, it's a expensive proposition to get started doing this, and if I can sell enough of these to keep going, then yes, I'll be doing revisions over time too.
How do you decide how many copies to print? Like, was that another conundrum?
It is a conundrum, and one I'm still working on, but part of it is just driven by what it costs to print them. That it's there are certainly advantages to printing larger quantities. This time around, I was going to try to do a smaller print run, but it was going to end up costing $8 to $9 a book to print a smaller quantity, versus roughly $4 a book for what I ended up printing. So, you know, it just at some point it's like, okay, I don't know if I can sell that many books, but if I can, then I'm in a much better financial position. And I can't make money if it costs me $8 or $9 to print one book. I'm not going to make any money from that.
Yeah, especially with all the time that you have to spend traveling and collating and writing and checking information.
Well, part of the reality, the economics, if I sell a book to a bookstore directly, they get a 40% discount off the cover price. So my take is 60% of the cover. And if I go through the distribution network, there's another discount off that. So books that go through a distributor to the bookstore, I get substantially less. So I think it would be about $8 a book is what would come to me from a book that sells through the distributor.
So that's another reason to be doing speaking engagements and selling books at the back of the room.
Right. I don't know if you wanted all that detail, but...
Well, I think writers are interested in... a lot of writers, I think, would like to self-publish and get started down this path, and that gives them some solid information as to what they're facing. Mm-hmm. So you have to have some money to invest to start.
You do. You know, self-publishing isn't necessarily cheap. You know, and these books have full-color covers, and then there are color inserts that increase the cost. And it's also a size that's not standard. It's 4x7, roughly. So, you know, I suppose if you printed books just purely black and white and made it a book size that was a little more common, then it probably would come in substantially less. But you're still looking at an investment up front to make it happen.
So you had a lot of different aspects, you know, different decision-making areas in doing this.
I've become an expert in so many things I never dreamed I was going to.
Yeah, so maybe you can be a consultant for people who are trying to do similar things.
Right.
How much are you using social media, like your Facebook page?
Well, you can follow the Mississippi Valley Traveler on Facebook, and I do. That's probably the one social networking site that I use most regularly because I can. It's easy to post events, so, you know, the talk tonight at Revelations Cafe. I can create an event on Facebook and have that announcement go out very easily. And then I have it set up so all those get fed to my Twitter account. So people that are following me on Twitter but not on Facebook, they still see all those announcements. And I've just started kind of exploring using, you know, really taking more advantage of those, of the potential of those sites. So I've been looking for people interested in travel along the Mississippi to follow on Twitter, for example, or looking for other travel writers in the same area to maybe start to follow some of them. But it's still, that's a work in progress, like for everybody else.
Yeah. I'm a little bit of a technophobe, so I'm still trying to figure out my cell phone, but I know that I need to learn all this.
Got to jump
stuff.
In.
Yeah.
You don't. There's really no choice at this point yet. This is one of the... one of the things I remember most from my weekend travel writing institute is one of the established travel writers there who's been doing this for over 30 years puts almost all of his content out on the internet. He has a website where, you know, all of the feature articles that he writes go on his website, and he has thumbnails of all his photographs. And somebody asked him, aren't you afraid of people stealing your work? And he said, I'm more afraid of invisibility.
Huh. So really, like everything that he would put in a book is on his website?
Pretty much.
And does he have advertising on his?
Like, he does.
Oh, so I guess that's it. You know, if you
that
can get
helps.
Advertisers, if you get enough traffic on your website, then that would
but
make
it also,
sense.
I think, then if there are editors, magazine editors that are surfing for particular content, they can see right away what the article looks like, and they can decide on the spot to inquire about purchasing that article from him.
But why would they want to purchase it if everybody can read it for free on the internet?
Well, they may still want it for their publication. For, you know, it may, because there's so many different segments to the market that it may be their readers aren't necessarily going
visiting
to be going
site.
To his website to read that content. So
I suppose it also could happen that if you know, a publisher visits your site and you're an expert in some particular area, they may ask you to do a project.
Right.
That kind of thing could come up.
Mm-hmm.
So again, what time are you going to be at Revelations?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock as part of the Art Walk celebration upstairs talking about traveling along the Mississippi. We don't have that much time left. Do you have any other final advice for writers?
Right. Just as the old advice is, you know, you guys got to dive in and start writing. And you can figure things out as you go along, but if you're not doing the writing, what's the point?
Well, that's the hard part. But I think having a real set goal, like where you have this goal of writing about the entire Mississippi, it gives you a structure. And now that you've done these first three books, you know what you're doing, so mm-hmm. the remaining ones should be a little easier. How are your friends and family reacting to what you're doing? Were people initially a little appalled that you quit your job to pursue earning a living through self-publishing?
Yeah, there was a lot of head scratching, I think, trying to figure out why would I leave a seemingly secure job to go do something as unknown and risky as this. But, you know, my job wasn't necessarily all that secure anyway. I was grant-supported in a non-tenure-track position. So, you know, as long as I was getting grants, I had job security. But it's a different world now anyway. Job security isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, sadly, that's true.
Right. You'd have to continue to make and remake yourself.
So looking back, say, excuse me. So let's say looking back at 80 as to, you know, what your writing career led to, what would you like to have happened as a result of quitting your job and setting out on this path? What are your dreams for yourself?
Well, I want to be known as the go-to expert for culture and history along the Mississippi River. Among, you know, that's first and foremost what I'd like to be. I don't have any illusions of being a Mark Twain, but certainly if when people think of the Mississippi, I want them to think about me.
Oh, that's great. So this has been Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. I've been sitting in for Monica Hadley and her mom, Carolyn. And I've been interviewing today Dean Klinkenberg. He's an author from St. Louis, and he has three travel guides out. Would you remind us the titles?
They're very cleverly named, the Quad Cities Travel Guide, the Lansing to LeClaire Travel Guide, and the Driftless Area Travel Guide.
This is KRUU-FM, 101 community-supported radio, and we've been getting lots of lessons in how to jump into the unknown, leave the known, and pursue a career self-publishing books. So anyone who's interested in learning more about this, Dean Klinkenberg will be at Revelations Cafe tonight at 6, and you also have a website.
I do, MississippiValleyTraveler.com.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.